Welcome to the Tech Vittori podcast, where we will explore the hottest topics in connectivity and digitalization with some of the industry's leading minds. This is going to be our opening panel discussion, charting the course, priorities for European connectivity leadership, and probably it is quite a challenging task to find right leaders for right leadership in right areas. But this is where we put our heads and minds together and try to do it. So, our moderator for this panel discussion, previously head of all things digital for the Estonian government, and as you know, Estonian government has been doing great in digital field. So now, an advisor to the Deputy Prime Minister of Ukraine and non-resident fellow at the International Center for Defense Studies in Tallinn, Lukas Ilves. Welcome.
Thank you, and please join me in welcoming to the stage a fantastic panel. I'm going to invite on the speakers one by one, and as I invite you, please come to my left. Karlis Bogens, head of the Fixed and Mobile Services Division at the ITU. Welcome, Karlis. Alexia Gonzalez Fanfalona, head of Connectivity Services and the Infrastructure and Infrastructures Unit at the OECD. Mark van Koppenol, VP of Policy and Government Affairs for EU and Europe at Nokia. Javier Albares, Head of Programs at the Smart Networks and Services Joint Undertaking. And last but not least, Vaiba Braža, Foreign Minister of the Republic of Latvia. Morning. So, what I want to say is that this is a great discussion and a great panel because it has the best elements of 5G tech rhetoric. It's not policymakers, it's not technologists, it's both. And of course, business people in the middle. And so we have a fairly diverse set of discussants here, so we really can sort of have that blending together of very big geopolitical considerations, but ultimately, and in a world where everything technological is also geopolitical and vice versa, get into some of the nitty-gritty of the technology environment that those geopolitics are occurring in. Let me take 1.5 minutes to set the scene. We've already heard a lot about what's going on in Brussels. And to zoom out from telecoms to look more broadly, first of all, there's a realization. People have said, okay, we have to deal with connectivity, but with competitiveness. But frankly, there's a realization, to quote Mario Draghi, that we have lost a generation, 30 years, to the US. And so, say some of the alarm bells are ringing to a greater extent than they have been in previous iterations of a new commission. And at the same time, we, of course, are in an increasingly geopolitical era, not just because of the gates of hell on the other side of our borders, but also the digital Cold War that is brewing in Asia and elsewhere. At the same time, we're also living in an era of technological paradigm changes. There's AI, which you know everyone has to talk about, and which I personally think is a paradigm shift on par with the arrival of the internet and the PC in the 1990s. But also, the technological paradigm for telecoms is changing under, or really we might say over, our feet. As satellite connectivity gets better and faster, and we're thinking about the technology stack for 6G, we feel like we've just mastered 5G, and already there's a whole bunch of new things to master. And so we're going to start off with Ms. Braža, who now is the Foreign Minister for Latvia, but previously was Assistant Secretary General at NATO for Public Diplomacy and has a long career as a diplomat for Latvia, to set the geopolitical scene. And maybe also tell us a little bit about how you, as a non-technologist, think about all these technology questions. And I will, even with our dear Foreign Minister, have to gently remind all the speakers at about 5 minutes that we have to move on. But please, Foreign
Thank
Minister.
Thank you very much. And we do have a bit of force majeure as we were planning this conference. And I would like to thank the team with whom we have worked. It's my second or third time at the event. But there is a budget debate in the parliament, so I will have to leave a bit early. So sorry for that. That's why the Prime Minister and Minister of Economy also left. But Let me just say the following. I think one of the issues that we have to look at, whether we are in the tech, whether, you know, the triple Felix, the government, academia, and the private sector, I think one of the issues that we seriously have to think is both reflect what was there in the past. Let's take a look 20 years ago. When we were working on the World Information Summit within the UN, and the world was just connected by a third. I mean, barely 30% of the world was connected to the internet. Now it's 66%. So we are moving as we speak to a global digital future. But connectivity is not enough, obviously. Connectivity doesn't per se bring innovation, it doesn't bring per se productivity, it doesn't bring all the factors that we are talking about, neither does regulation. So how do we actually connect all those forces? So I think there are several aspects that the governments can play a role. It can be an enabler, not only for digital infrastructure, for fixed infrastructure, for regulation and so on and so forth, but actually enabling the smaller and medium-sized enterprises where a lot of innovation, where a lot of development will take place to work with more traditional companies, providing that safe computing space, providing that safe critical infrastructure, providing that sort of reliability of the future, that their IP, for example, won't be swallowed up by the big companies, that they won't be squeezed out of the market, that there will be those partnerships, that there will be that ability actually for smaller companies to continue providing that innovation and tech. The other aspect that I would like to note is actually looking currently at the defense tech. In real, if we speak about AI or other developments, where what we are seeing in Ukraine, and you are spending some of your time in Ukraine, as many of us are, where actually the AI-enabled warfare has equalized the opportunities for Ukrainians against much larger superiority, whether it's Air Force of Russia and so on and so on. So there is that smaller agile force capability using the AI as we speak on the battlefield, but also applying it to the wider sort of perspective to equalize opportunities. And whether we say it's a human managed or human is involved in decision making, in a number of cases it won't be. In intelligence, for example, the AI plays an enormous role, but whether it's on gathering, analyzing information, targeting, and so on and so forth. But also what we see in drones, there are situations when humans are not involved. Let's put it out there. So the traditional sort of application of the ethical principles that we speak about in this situation is not any more valid. Because at the end, in the situation where Ukraine is implementing its self-defense within the UN context against a much larger aggressive force, the least they care about is ethical application of AI when they use the drones to go after the Russians. So let's sort of grade then how we approach this. And the third big angle that I would like to note is actually the workforce. And I think here, the traditional approach that it's all about STEM, that it's all about, you know, building up the engineering capabilities, that how we all become engineering societies, I would just like to note that creativity, humanities actually matter. Like with vaccines, we can develop whatever vaccines we want. It's not going to change anything. It's vaccination. It's action. It's the attitude that changes the situation. So in that respect, for the workforce, again, in my view, the wider involvement of the skilled population and bringing up both the level of IQ of emerging disruptive technologies, having, again, those safe spaces of experimentation, a conscious outreach, whether to art academies or anything else, and combining those various groups is something that will bring us, and I speak about democracies. I don't speak about Europe or non-Europe, but really about democracies, because that's the end, I think, in today's world that we talk about. That it will create those advantages, because in democracies you can be creative, you can question established truths, you can question power, you can go after them. That is something which is a great advantage for us. So with that workforce, but also then, for example, creating between the governments and private sector some type of understanding that we do, if necessary, have that surge capability from the private sector or other sectors into the government in situations when it's needed. That we do have that resilience ability is something that I would say we sort of have to consciously create in the future. Whether we can do it at the international, national, or European level, I really don't care, but those are the issues I would like to put out there, and not as the official cabinet position, but actually as something to challenge.
Thank you. Those are very provoking thoughts, especially, I think, the question you raise in AI ethics. I want to provoke you with one more question. In the physical kinetic world, thankfully, Latvia is not at war with Russia. At the same time, if we look into what's happening in the digital world, both in the world of bits and bytes, cyber attacks, but also when it comes to jamming of radio frequencies of GPS, attacks on physical connectivity, on telecoms infrastructures in the Baltic Sea, one could argue that Russia at least is waging a one-sided war against the Baltics and, of course, more broadly as a result, NATO. How are you reacting to that? And are we being too soft, given that the digital environment has basically become a theater of war?
All right. I think you're touching upon several layers. One is the resilience of the infrastructure. Obviously, what we do as critical infrastructure providers, in our case, LVRTC, the Latvian Radio TV Center, asserts the sort of government part of things and the wider critical infrastructure part of things is one issue, because you will need to provide, and that's in accordance with NATO's resilience baselines, you will need to be able to provide continuance of functioning of the government services, of hospitals, and so on and so forth. So that is obviously constantly that needs to be tested.
As foreign minister, diplomatically, you're under attack.
Yeah, and your task as a government is actually to play out scenarios and constantly participate in various, I wouldn't say even exercises, but they actually play out actual situations how to defend. Because, okay, we don't do offensive cyber officially, and I can't say that we do unofficially, but we know countries who do have officially recognized cyber attack capabilities. And I think that is something that also is a deterrence. I don't think that the attribution per se is a deterrence of something. It allows policy action. It allows restrictive measures, or it allows other policy action. It creates awareness of the society. It creates resilience. So there the sort of attribution plays a role. But again, you have to be very conscious that there has to be a bottom line. Your critical infrastructure and ability, constantly testing, constantly literally war gaming and playing both sides, the red and blue teams, actually helps. Then there is obviously, we do know the cyber attacks take place not only from Russia, but also China. It has been attributed to Microsoft, the Iranian one on Albania and others. So we do know that is an everyday occurrence. Do our people know? How do we create the overall resilience in the society, that cyber hygiene, that people just don't do stupid things? It will never be 100% guarantee, but again, we as societies, and there the role of influencers comes in, there's the role of various other parts of society come in, because they are the ones who can distribute that knowledge, that message to as wide groups as possible. Like a bit of sort of nodes that we are in the society, that it's not a centrally organized society in democracy anymore. It's really various decentralized groups, and that's how we have to approach cyber defense. But also, if we speak about deterrence, there are various ways. You know, remember, US went after Colonial Pipeline and just took the money back and took them.
Thank you.
So there is various ways how you can do it, but again, not everything has to be spelled out beforehand. Thanks.
Thank you. I want to turn now to Carlos for a slightly different scene setter. Maybe to say a few introductory words about Carlos, I had a ChatGPT discussion about you with the AI, and basically arrived at the conclusion that you are the hidden hand of telecoms policy at the ITU, or of radio spectrum policy for the last 30 years. And so I think the question that I want to put to you is, what's the landscape that all us policymakers are actually working in? What have you already agreed at a global level? What do we have to look forward to in the next decade?
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Just to let me start with a brief background on the functions of the ITU. So one of the functions is to define and manage international regulatory framework for the use of radio spectrum and satellite orbits by radio communication services, including development of worldwide standards on the new technologies. The major decisions for the radio communication sector are made by World Radio Communication Conferences, so-called WRCs, which take place every 4 years. The main objectives of the WRCs are to enable spectrum for emerging radio technologies. At the same time, to protect the existing systems, radio systems, achieve spectrum harmonization, and create regulatory certainty for the spectrum users. The decisions of WRC are reflected in the revised radio regulations, which is the international treaty governing the use of radio spectrum. So it is signed by all of member states who participate at the conference. Just to give you some background on the previous year's conference, the last year's conference was the largest ever conference. Around 4,000 delegates participated from 163 member states and 151 sector members. And so, with respect to the outcomes of WRCs, I just like to share some key outcomes on the broadband. First, on broadband connectivity, the conference identified several mid-range bands for IMT, which will contribute not only to IMT 2020, known as 5G, but also to IMT development of future IMT 2030, or 6G, known as the brand name 6G. Secondly, the conference also identified frequency bands for the use by high-altitude platform stations as IMT base stations, HIPS, so-called HIPS, and establish regulations for their operations. So this identification offers new means of providing mobile broadband connectivity to underserved communities and rural and remote areas. This technology requires minimal infrastructure and use the same frequencies and devices as IMT networks. If we talk about numbers, last year's conference identified 1.3 gigahertz of spectrum additionally for IMT. So broadband communications was also extended to the sea and the air. Regulatory provisions and interference management mechanisms were put in place to allow earth stations in motion, so-called eSIMs, on aircraft and vessels to communicate with geostationary and non-geostationary space stations in the fixed satellite service. So this is extension of IMT terrestrial or any terrestrial network where the ship or aircraft is outside the terrestrial network coverage. So this new system provides broadband coverage. So based on fixed satellite service. So what's coming next? The new study cycle has already begun in the preparation for the conference in 2027. As regards broadband, the ITU study possible identification of new frequency bands at 4, 7, and 14 gigahertz for the terrestrial component of IMT. These bands will be crucial, in fact, for enabling the new generation of mobile connectivity in 2030. On satellite broadband, studies consider possible new allocations to the mobile satellite service for direct connectivity between space stations and IMT user equipment to complement terrestrial IMT network coverage. Studies also consider new mobile satellite services for developing the satellite-based IoT, Internet of Things, in the bands between 1.4 to 2 gigahertz. And so the issue is that IoT provided over terrestrial networks have limitations in remote and underserved areas and can be well complemented with satellite IoT. Just in addition to the broadband, ITU under WRC 27 agenda also study future development of communications on the lunar surface and between lunar orbit and lunar surface. So there are many other agenda items. I just briefly covered the most important topics which made me interested for this forum. So next about 6G standardization. We heard many talks about 6G and future. So with respect to IMT standardization, I would like to note that ITUR develops high-level standards, such as concept, performance requirements, and specifications. And then furthermore, detailed standards that are used for manufacturing equipment are developed by other organizations such as 3GPP, ETSI, or EEEE, regional or also global standardization organizations. And all 3G, 4G, and 5G mobile broadband systems are based on the ITU standards for IMT. The standardization process, as we see in this chart on the screen, has already started. And with respect to 6G standardization, ITUR has completed initial development phase. So just to formalize, last year's radio assembly approved the revision of resolution, WRC resolution, confirming the name of next generation to be IMT 2030, so known as the brand name 6G, and also approved the new recommendation on ITUR, IMT 2030 framework. The work on the next generation will further focus now on the minimum performance requirements and the detailed evaluation criteria. And from, as we see on this chart at the end, so from 2025 to 2027, the industry will provide candidate radio interface technologies, and ITUR will start the evaluation process. This, in fact, looks very similar to IMT 2020, or known as 5G standardization process. The only difference is that there are different years and dates. Just to conclude, these are some considerations and timelines from the global perspective. It is indeed critical time with fast-paced developments of technologies to ensure appropriate provisions are in place. So, thank you.
Thank you. Maybe a quick follow-up question. You mentioned that the conference talked about connectivity on the moon. That's pretty interesting. What's going on with space? I mean, just in a very broad sense, is it a paradigm shift? Is all of our connectivity going to be coming from satellites in the near future?
Yes, space is coming to the game, in fact, of IMT, as we see with these recent broadband developments. And this is mainly, it is driven by technology developments, because technology allows now space systems, especially the satellites in low Earth orbit, to provide similar services as terrestrial component of IMT. So just I would like to highlight with respect to satellite broadbands. So as already mentioned, we have an agenda item. ITU has an agenda item for direct to handset connectivity and satellite IoT. For the eSIMs, all of these are broadband systems. And future developments is assist lunar communications. So if I may just elaborate a little bit more. So non-GSO mobile satellite service systems will be ready soon to provide direct handset connectivity to complement IMT network coverage. And there are several factors which are driving this new trend, including the deployment of low Earth orbit, availability of smaller and more affordable satellites, reduced launch costs, and advancements in technology, such as beamforming, larger antennas on spacecraft, and also software-defined radios. Because the mobile phone has to connect to the space station, so, and yeah, it has to have knowledge about the frequencies and further details. So, then satellite IoT will provided over terrestrial networks. So as we know, terrestrial part has its limitations, and satellite will be used for remote and underserved areas. So eSIMs we already mentioned, and future developments of cislunar communications. I would like just to say that there are several missions now launched on the moon. The multinational efforts such as Artemis campaign and the International Lunar Research Station program. They are bringing many countries as well as private actors to develop missions to the moon in the forthcoming years. And as cislunar activity increases, radio frequency requirements in the cislunar environment will continue to grow. And also complexity. So therefore, the task of this agenda item for this conference is to study the propagation, radio wave propagation, also technical criteria, how to ensure that systems are compatible, which are used by different missions, and there is no harmful interference.
So. Wow. So you've laid out kind of the roadmap of what the world's going to be working on. And thank you again, Ms. Foreign Minister, for joining us. And I only hope that the budget negotiations give lots of money to digital. I want to turn next to Javier Alvarez, who is the head of programs at the joint undertaking of, I guess, the European Commission, but more broadly of Europe, for smart networks and services. For those who don't know, it's sort of Europe's PPP to make sure that we keep up in 6G development and also manage to deploy 5G in Europe. And so we've kind of had the ITU lay out the roadmap as a whole of what's going to be happening globally. Your job is to make sure that Europe is part of that.
Yes, and I think hearing what has been said here before, I just want to share maybe three big ideas with you and with the people here, with the audience. The first one is, has been mentioned, we are a joint undertaking, so that is a public-private partnership, and I think it's one of the potential solutions to the problem that we face. I think we need to strengthen the collaboration between the public and the private sector. In our case, we have a very good collaboration between the European Commission, which is one of our funding members, and the private sector, so that is one comment. The second is that, and I think it has been mentioned here before, we are at the initial stage of a very long cycle. It's an end-to-end process. So if you want to bring innovation to the market and really have impact, and I think we have KPIs that are related with the impact at the program level, you have to think that you have to move from good R&D, so scientific excellence, you have to move that into the standardization that has been mentioned before. So it's very important that European technology is integrated into the standards of the future. That standardized technology has to be deployed in the market, and there is a discussion also on how we are going to finance infrastructure, and I think this is part of the conversation. And finally, this needs to be accepted by the private sector, the vertical sectors that really use it in the economic world. And I think this is also important for us. We have a specific stream dedicated to collaboration with the verticals in Europe. So only when you do all these things right, and there are a lot of challenges in each of the stages of this process and a lot of feedback loops that can basically derail the process, you can really close the, let's say, the big cycle of technology sovereignty. And I think we have to be mindful that the process can fail in many stages, and that we have to, and that is why it's important the collaboration between the private sector and the public sector. And the third comment is on the concept of ecosystem. It has been mentioned here before several times. To me, the big question is what kind of ecosystem we want to have in Europe. Because it's not the same thing to have an ecosystem in Europe than to have a European ecosystem. The type of digital world that we are basically creating, it's already here, by the way, it's going to just grow bigger, is that you have very big, already established players that are leading, sponsoring ecosystems. So the big decision is if you want to join one of these big ecosystems or if you want to create one of your own. I think the big question for Europe is if we think that we have the ability, the will, the capabilities, the final resources to create our own ecosystem and not be dependent on third-party ecosystems. We can always be complementors of others' ecosystems, and maybe this is part of the competitive space, but I think the question big here, and what we are trying to collaborate, I mean, humbly, from our side, is to try to at least give Europe the chance to have its own technology ecosystem on this front. So,
can I ask you a quick provocative follow-up? When you say Europe with its own ecosystem, does that mean a sort of sovereign fortress Europe ecosystem, let's keep the Americans and the Chinese out, or what does that mean?
I think we have to apply, I would say, system thinking to the process. At the first principle level, in system thinking, you have the concept of stock, the concept of flows, and the concept of interfaces. These are the three big things that you have to keep in mind. To me, the question of having a 5G ecosystem, European 5G ecosystem, is to have the possibility to operate at the stock level, at the flow level, and at the interface level with sovereignty. Okay, that if that means relying on others, I mean, there are a lot of devils in the detail, but I think everybody understands that there are things that today we cannot control at all, and that probably we can try to see if there is something we can do.
Well, let's next turn to Mark. You represent Nokia, who certainly in any model of systems thinking is a pretty crucial node in that European and global system. How do you look at the questions that have just been raised by Javier? How are we doing? Are we going to have that European ecosystem?
Yeah, thank you for this important debate to discuss the priorities on European leadership. And indeed, so as Nokia, we are a B2B technology innovation leader, so we are providing trusted, fixed mobile and cloud networking solutions to telecom operators, enterprises, and governments worldwide. And R&D is a critical thing for us because we invest more than 20% of our sales in R&D, so 4 billion a year. I just wanted to highlight, you know, on the ecosystem and the challenges that we have at European level, because as most of you know, as Europe, you know, we have fallen behind the US and China in terms of economic growth. And the issue is that the gap risks actually widening because of digitalization delays, which are being caused by a lack of network investments going forward. And if you look at the situation today, there is a lack of actually 200 billion to reach the 2030 European Commission digitalization decade target, which says that by 2030 we should have the full population covered by 5G, and then also have all households reached by gigabit connectivity. And you know, there is also an issue in terms of innovation in Europe. I mean, I saw a study that out of 17 ICT, AI, and quantum innovation technologies, actually other regions are leading 13 of them.
So it's clear that a lot needs to be done. We know that obviously there are the Draghi reports, the white paper that were referred to before, which make a correct assessment of the situation and which is also which are also providing some recommendations. But for sure, for Europe to regain its economic competitiveness, there must first be a digital competitiveness which is being reached. And there are a number of things that we need to do to reach that. I would say the first is that, as already highlighted through this 200 billion, we need to have more investments in trusted telecom infrastructure in Europe. And there are, for that, a number of things that need to be done. We need to have healthy telecom operators that have the sufficient scale. Today, we have a problem with that, and you know this is something that we have to address collectively. We also need to have trusted equipment in all parts of the networks, not just 5G. You know, there is fiber, there is IP, there is optics, so all these parts of networks to have the sufficient resilience must have trusted equipment. Also, we know that there is not everywhere connectivity. You know, we have areas which are not connected because the business case may not be, you know, interesting for operators because of insufficient population. But for sure, for some use cases like agriculture or even for defense, it is important to have this region covered as well with connectivity. And it means also that we have to have the necessary funding and financing for covering these regions. Would also like to add that, you know, as most of you know, there is no green without digital. And so this also means that connectivity can help decarbonize other sectors. And so it is actually today illogical that connectivity is not part of the EU taxonomy, which provides, you know, an instrument for green financing to sectors helping decarbonize. And so we believe that also funding and financing towards the telecom connectivity could be done by having the connectivity part of the EU taxonomy, which is today not the case. Finally, we also need to prepare for the future. We talked about 6G earlier today, and to have Europe in the leadership in 6G position, we need to have, you know, spectrum in place in time. One of the reasons why Europe was, you know, or is delayed in 5G versus other regions of the world is because of a late allocation of 5G spectrum. And so we need to make sure that this gets solved for 6G that, as we saw, will come around 2030, making sure that we have a better coordination for 6G amongst the member states going forward. And finally, one word about research and innovation. We need to make sure that in Europe we are incentivizing the right areas for R&D. The industrial internet is an example for that. As most of you know, Europe did miss the consumer internet leadership, but for the industrial internet leadership, there is obviously a big opportunity for Europe to lead. There is a huge amount of industrial data that can be, you know, harnessed and used through AI to create, you know, additional productivity and also being from a green perspective in the leadership. So, you know, taking all that together, I think we have huge opportunities in Europe, but it is important that we act together in collaboration, but also with urgency. And so, you know, looking at the mission letters of the next commission, there is a lot in there that makes sense and that we should obviously work together on to make sure that we advance in the European leadership on connectivity.
Thank you. I'm going to turn immediately to Alexia González-Fanfalone because I want to get some debate going here after that. You have a global perspective from the OECD on all of these connectivity questions. Though you are physically based in Europe, if you kind of zoom out and look from space, as it were, what does Europe look like, you know, in terms of all of these policy questions around connectivity versus the rest of the world?
Thank you very much, and this is an excellent question. So for those of you that are not that familiar with the OECD has 38 member countries spanning from the Americas and Asia, but importantly, 22 EU member countries are part of the OECD, and there's three other EU member countries in accession. And against the backdrop of all the challenges that were mentioned here today in the keynotes and also in this panel, from climate change to inequalities, geopolitical fragmentation, digital transformation is really is a defining shift of our times, and it does offer this hope of how to advance sustainable, inclusive growth. So I guess we all agree connectivity is the backbone of digital transformation, and so this key sector has impact on productivity gains across all sectors of the economy, and hence countries' competitiveness, which is one of the words used in vogue today. And so the challenge is how to close these connectivity divides and also future-proof networks, render them more resilient and environmentally sustainable. So we know that the communication sector is capital intensive, and this means that significant investments are needed both to upgrade networks and expand coverage. But what our evidence shows at the OECD for the past decades, and we have been accompanied countries in the liberalization of their telecom markets, providing what are the policies to expand high quality and affordable connectivity to all, what we've learned is that sound regulatory and institutional frameworks that promote both competition and investments are a must. So this is key. To answer your question, where do we stand? We have been making progress to the goal of connecting people to the latest generation of broadband networks. For example, since December 2019 to 2023, the share of gigabit fixed broadband subscriptions has more than tripled in the OECD area. Fiber connections in December 23 accounted for 42% of all fixed broadband connections, and this is from 28% than when we had in December 2019. So pre-pandemic, right? So a lot of investment has been going on to upgrade and future-proof networks across the OECD. And it's worth mentioning that out of the seven OECD leading countries in terms of the share of fiber in total fixed broadband subscriptions that have more than 75% of the subscriptions being fiber, five of them are European countries. So we have Korea, Iceland, Spain, Lithuania, Japan, Latvia, our host country, and Sweden. And there's no 5G without fiber, so that's why I started talking about fiber. So the good news is that 5G rollout continues at pace in 37 out of 38 OECD countries and now comprises a third of mobile broadband connections. As was mentioned, 6G research is ongoing across the world, but notably in 15 OECD countries. However, while progress has been made, it is not equally distributed. There's persistent gaps remaining between and within countries, especially when we talk about rural and remote areas. So what are the policies to ensure investment in high-quality connectivity? First, as I mentioned before, we need a sound regulatory framework which fosters competition and provides investment certainty. These two pillars go hand in hand, together with a regulator that does impartial decisions in an independent manner, and that's very important for investment certainty, especially in a sector such as the communication sector, where the investments are in the long term. So running the risk of debunking a common argument that we may hear nowadays in Europe, our evidence across the OECD shows that competition has been a main driver for broadband development. There is really no trade-off between competition and investment. They go hand in hand. Competition allows players in the market to be at the top of their game, to innovate, to continue upgrading networks. At the same time, we see the gains that we on affordability that it may bring. And affordability is one of the main barriers to uptake of broadband. This can be infrastructure-based competition or retail-based competition, and evidently the ecosystem of connectivity is evolving with new players. But I'll just pause here to provide one example that's non-European and is the example of Mexico. In 2013, Mexico overhauled the telecommunications framework. It basically allowed foreign direct investment in the market. It created an independent regulator. And as we see 10 years down the line, from 2013 to 2023, what have been the tangible benefits of a new entry and changes in the institutional framework? We see that prices of mobile broadband were decreased 85%. This allowed many people to access to the internet for the first time. And the amount of additional mobile broadband subscriptions in these 10 years has been 94 million subscriptions, mobile broadband. And to put the number in perspective, that's the entire population of Peru and Colombia together. So competition yields benefits, and it is important to promote broadband development. Now, of course, we need to strengthen the evidence base, and a lot of the discussions today is on in the investment gaps and what is needed to mitigate that gap. But first, we need to know who's who in the connectivity ecosystem, who has been investing. And a recent report we published in June 2024 that was mentioned by Robert Murick, and Chairman Robert Murick in his keynote on financing broadband networks of the future, provides one piece of the puzzle for this evidence base, including what are the broad range of actors that are investing in broadband networks. Of course, it is operators in the market, but there's also big tech companies, financial asset managers that are investing more and more in wholesale access networks such as FiberCos, tower companies, and of course the public sector. And we've seen a lot of public state aid that's going into bridging these connectivity divides, notably the United States with the $65 billion to promote the deployment of broadband, but also in Europe with the Recovery and Resilience Funds. So as networks evolve and the ecosystem evolves, of course we have to evolve two policies, two regulators and policymakers have to be at the top of their game. And what is important to provide incentives to keep investing in these networks is efficient spectrum management, and licensing frameworks here are key, as well as reducing deployment costs such as infrastructure sharing and lower the barriers to the deployment, amongst others, which Europe is currently doing and enhancing. And so what I would like to say today, ladies and gentlemen, is that we suggest to continue working with this momentum, agreeing on the premise that, of course, the connectivity has a lot to bring to productivity across all sectors, and that's why affordable and high-quality connectivity are important. And we really look forward to a conversation of how to bring this shared ambition of the next evolution of broadband networks to all a reality.
Thank you. I think it's important maybe for the audience sake to say that, you know, behind a lot of these quite abstract words, we have a situation where there's an asymmetry in how different parts of connectivity are regulated. So we have this dilemma, in a sense. We have this very successful historical policy of quite strong regulation of fixed connectivity in order to sort of end the era of monopoly incumbents and create competition both on services and infrastructure. And so if you're an operator with fiber, there's a lot of price regulation, much less regulation when it comes to mobile operators, and even less when it comes to everything that's coming from above and, of course, the over-the-top services. And so the dilemma is we have this quite strict regulatory framework that's worked, and you laid out some of the evidence. But on the other hand, we have this asymmetry. Before we get to that, I do want to ask Carlos for one empirical question. Alexis gave us sort of some numbers on fiber rollout and the success there. What are the success numbers look like for 5G rollout? Who's leading the world there?
So, overall, I think 5G is still a technology for rich countries. So, such as Asia, big Asian economies, Arab countries. Europe is doing very well, in fact, and USA. So if you look at Africa, so it is not so well developed for the time being. It creates some digital divide, because the issue is that 5G technology is still quite expensive. So if you look at the statistics on the number of 5G base stations, for instance, China is a leader in this domain. It has more than 5 million base stations, 5G, base stations. So USA is also very good, in fact, and it is thanks to T-Mobile development at 600 megahertz. So it has hundreds of thousands base stations which ensure good coverage. So if you look at the map of 5G deployment worldwide. So 5G is important. I mean, all depends on the use cases for what you need 5G. So 5G is also important for industries, as we all know. And that was one of driving factors to develop the standard, because it is much better than 4G, I mean, with respect to latency, so numbers of users in square kilometer and so on. So again, the countries with powerful economies such as China, Germany, Korea, Japan, USA are leaders in this segment. So if we look at European examples of 5G deployment, I mean, there are many, many examples for agriculture, for industries. For instance, Germany with smart factories. So it's also a good example I like to mention. I mean, if we look at agriculture, on agricultural side, it's Norway with fishing firms who uses 5G as a technology to manage fishing firms, and there are many other examples. In fact, it's developing very well in Europe, in my view. And if you look at the latest numbers worldwide, so we have about 335 operators in 126 countries who had launched or soft launched 5G mobile networks. I mean, the numbers, I mean, we see that now it's started to be growing, but still the issue is that the technology is maybe still too expensive, and for developing countries, they cannot keep up the same speed as developed countries.
So, Javier, Mark, I'll let you figure out who answers first, but if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It seems to be kind of what I'm hearing here from the OECD and the ITU. Or maybe we could phrase it differently, that Europe's digital competitiveness challenges, while very real, are maybe in other layers of the stack. Is that too happy a view of things? What do you think?
This is for me, sorry. I would reframe the discussion here, because I think we are missing the big point. The digital economy as a whole, it's 16-18% of the GDP, according to OECD figures, and it's going to double in size in the next 7 years. So it's going to 15 or 16 trillion US dollars of new value are going to be created just in the next 6 years. So that is, I think, the big discussion, how much of that we are going to get. Today, Europe market share is between 5 and 10, so it's literally below our GDP in general economy. And also, as OECD has mentioned in the last report, I think Alexia wrote it, the digital economy is growing at 3 times the rate at the rate at which the general economy is growing. So to me, the message here would be, first, let's have a bit more optimism on the opportunity, because there is a big correlation between techno-optimism and the ability to capture growth in the mid to long term. And when you look at the ranking of techno-optimism of countries, European countries are at the bottom quartile. At the top, you have China, South Korea, all the usual suspects. So I would say, let's reframe it, because I think we have a huge opportunity in front of us if we are able to manage ourselves. And the second is on connectivity. I think it's the connectivity of the future is not going to be like the connectivity of the past. And we are talking about the connectivity of the past. And I think when you read the white paper that was mentioned before that the Commission has published, I think the connectivity of the future is this connected, collaborative compute continuum in which you are going to have a lot of things in a melting pot. And I think we have to look at connectivity from that point of view. To me, the question is, if we are not so far behind in connectivity, traditionally connectivity, why are we so far behind in capturing value in the digital world? And this is, I think, what the people in this room and the decision makers, the political decision makers, probably have to work out, and this is what we would like to collaborate with and to try to discuss in depth, because otherwise we are never going to, if we continue doing the same things, I don't think we are going to get a different result.
Mark, please.
Yeah, perhaps just a remark on connectivity. I mean, if you look at 5G, actually where Europe is lagging, it's in standalone 5G. I mean, if you look at the number of base stations that are standalone 5G, which is the real 5G, meaning that you're able to do the network slicing and, you know, all these technologies that enable the digitalization of vertical sectors, probably, you know, today half of the, or even less than the base stations is standalone 5G. So that's actually a critical area where Europe should improve. And then the second remark I'd like to make is related to AI, because AI will have a fundamental impact on the future of connectivity. You know, in the way networks are being run, in the way, you know, networks are maintained, the predictivity of, you know, in terms of loads, in terms of cybersecurity, etc. So there is a tremendous aspect, not only in 6G, but already in 5G, on the impact of AI to improve connectivity going forward.
Alexei, you want to react?
Sure. I just want to chime in on the technological trends that are shaping networks and the connectivity ecosystem, and we have identified five of them, which is, of course, the use of AI in networks, the increased virtualization of networks, the cloud integration into them, openness of networks, a trend towards that, but also the integration of terrestrial and non-terrestrial networks. And of course, this means that the connectivity ecosystem is changing, and this poses new challenges for regulators. And what we've found in our work on how regulators are adapting to this, and their mandates are actually currently expanding in the OECD to broader digital issues, including AI, cloud, OTTs. And we've seen this from 2021 to 2023. And I wanted to mention this because you remind me of Estonian. Our digital economy outlook will be published and launched in Estonia on the 20th of November, and we will be presenting these trends. So the challenge is there, of course. The connectivity ecosystem is changing. This has implications to market structure. Instead of debilitating regulators, and as much as how are we going to strengthen the ecosystem and the arbiters in that ecosystem so that both competition and investment continue flourishing, taking into account the diversity of players.
Okay, I mean, let me just ask a naive question. Supply and demand, it seems that all of our layers on top, data, what we're doing with AI, all the applications should create more demand. And if the demand's there, then shouldn't that just solve all of our investment problems? What's getting in the way of classic supply and demand making everyone happy without government intervention? Just a really stupid, naive question, but sometimes those can be helpful. I don't know, of the four of you, if anyone wants to go first on that.
So,
well, maybe from what we have seen, it's difficult to... probably because of this discussion on techno-optimism versus techno-pessimism in Europe, I think it's difficult to break the catch-22 cycle of not investing because you don't see the demand, and because there is no investment, there is no demand. So that is why I think the public sector collaboration with the private sector can help. Mm-hmm. I think we can just unlock this initial, ignite this machine, and create a positive loop. We are trying to, I think, but I think we have to be very focused on a few sectors, vertical sectors, that are important for the European economy, and where we can show results in a relatively short period of time. We are working with companies like Nokia, for example, on that, on several projects, and actually, I think we have a session on that later today. So. I think it's the way to and I think one more thing, I think it's also an opportunity to collaborate between the European budget and the national budgets. I think there are synergies that can be created here because there are a lot of areas of commonalities that we can find. So,
Mark?
I think the demand is there. I mean, I was recently on a panel together with someone from the energy sector who was actually saying that, I mean, they would like to digitalize more and further, but, you know, because of the lack of standalone 5G, they were kind of limited in that. I mean, if you look at the energy sector, putting you know, solar and wind into the windmills into the grid requires digitalization of that grid. You know, making sure that you can balance generation and demand. And so the point the person was making is that they are looking for, you know, better, faster, and more available connectivity in order to be able to digitalize those grids. So I think from a demand perspective, depending on the sector, it's there, but we also need to make sure the right supply is available.
Alexia?
Yes, I think it's a great point to touch upon standalone 5G because a lot of the revolutionary aspects that are mentioned were mentioned depend on that. And in the first one of the keynote speech I noted from Mr. Bragg, digital leadership requires partnerships. And I guess here it's important to note, of course, that these aspects of standalone 5G requires as much as the standards, as the policies, as the business models and how it's implemented in the market. And this is holds true also for 6G after 2030 when we will see commercial deployments. So I guess as we go to ultra latency and massive communications, so more into the industrial internet, and what will be key for this ecosystem is all these partnerships, joint and private, public, and all stakeholders. But I also want to note here that as we look at future standards of development that's continue of the standards, is how the overarching policy objectives that we want, which is sustainability and inclusion, how are they going to be mapped into the standardization phase, so the KPIs of the standards? And for that, that's why these conversations amongst different stakeholders are very important. And at the OECD, we provide a forum for that among the countries and stakeholders, but this type of events is key for this conversation.
So maybe to draw things together, I want to pick on a thought that I think Javier introduced, which is that we have this sort of long thread. And on one end, we have, you know, R&D and fundamental research, you know, pushing the edge of what physics can do. And certainly when we get into quantum communications, it really is about the fundamental nature of physics. On the other hand, we have these sort of basic questions of geopolitics and, you know, sort of what is right and what is wrong. And the challenge that we all have in front of us is that we have to get things right on every single, you know, step of that process or every sort of section of that thread. And it would be challenging and complex enough if it were just a question of sort of economic, regulatory, and technology policy, not helped by the fact that, frankly, telecoms policy is kind of boring to non-specialists. I mean, I can say trying to explain, you know, network regulation to a new minister who doesn't have that background is challenging. Carlos, you know, trying to explain the nuances of different, you know, different frequency bands and how propagation works differently and why this all matters, it's challenging. And then we have on that, you know, something that collides completely from the side, which is, of course, the questions of war and peace, that we can't all just kind of exist as economic policymakers, technologists, and researchers in our own bubble, but there are actors out there who aren't playing by the rules, and that we have to sort of have a paranoid mindset alongside the open-mindedness and the generativity and the creativity that we need to have to get things right. So I don't think this panel has given us answers. That was not our goal. Our goal was, frankly, to raise some difficult questions, to provoke everyone a bit, and to remind everyone that we do have to look at all these things put together. And I think that's something that's going to happen a lot over the next 2 days. So I want the audience to thank all of the panelists who joined us. First of all, thank you very much.